Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. It is hot, hot, hot across the country, and we have some fire-dropping people here today. We've got Chris Ortega from Amasis, and we have Glenn Snyder from Global Growth. Welcome, gentlemen.
What's up? Great
to be here.
All right, today we've got an awesome topic, something we talk a little bit about. You know, we kind of nudge in every now and then and talk about special projects that FP&A can lead and participate in. And today we want to go deep on that topic. Normally we're kind of covering core aspects of FP&A, but today we want to jump in and see where we can send the special ops teams, do the things that are really going to make a big impact to the business, and talk about, you know, what benefits you get out of doing that, what experiences you can get out of doing that, some risks associated with doing that, and how to account for them and plan for them. And you know, where else can you go? Like, how as an FP&A person can you go out into the business and really try and provide that superpower that FP&A leaders have? So, Chris, I'd love to start with you. What are some of the special projects or special ops projects you've tackled or had your team tackle before?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm really excited about this topic because I think it's so important for us to realize that FP&A and accounting and finance don't go the traditional route, right? So, like, my first project won't be going to the sales, won't be going to the marketing. I want to change it up and mix it up. I think the first place that a really special ops FP&A project that you can go work with is directly get aligned with your HR and your people management, right? The people aspect of our businesses are the most important. And if you want to find a business partner inside the organization that shares a lot of the collaboration, communication, a lot of the frustrations, they're the blunt of everything coming to the business, go talk to HR. So one of the great projects that I got to work on that is really like outside of the box when it comes to FP&A, accounting and financing, you wouldn't expect us to be leading this, was I had the opportunity in my career to completely revamp a human capital strategy, right? A human capital strategy is basically we in accounting, finance, and FP&A, we were a small team. We were the legal people, we were the finance people, we were the accounting people, we were the risk people, we were the benefits people, we were the it was four people on the team and we wore all these different hats. We were like the office manager, and then even sometimes I would get like lunch and snacks for clients or for our employees. So this project that we got to work on was a human capital strategy, and it basically was a project management role that we took upon to guide our organizations, our teams, our functional roles, right? Getting functional roles aligned, getting functional roles to know what their career progression could possibly be in the role that they're in, getting those roles aligned to compensation, right? Like, we did a complete valuation of our compensation models. Like, some people were on variable compensation, some people were on bonuses, some people were on spiffs. They were all across the board. And ultimately, we did all of this human capital planning, benefits, compensation, titles, job descriptions, right? This may sound crazy, but we had like everybody had their own job description. Like, you had a customer success manager that was saying they were a, you know, it was just all across the board. So we standardized our roles. We standardized our functional responsibilities. We level set people's compensation to get a more consistent structure about what the role that they were doing. But all of this was driving towards the focus of our business, which were the strong KPIs around driving revenue, decreasing costs, making sure we're more efficient and optimized, and building collaboration inside the business. So we marshaled this entire effort, right? And let me just be transparent, right? It was a 250, 300 employee organization, right? There's no way that would have scaled if I was trying to do this in an 8,000, 10,000 person organization or team that was a part of. But what we brought to the business was this alignment and this connective collaboration to all the strategies that we were talking about as a leadership team, cascading it all the way down. And one way we were able to do that is we didn't have knowledge experts in benefits management, compensation management. We leverage great partners. So where we were weak when it came around benefits and how do we get the best benefit packages? How are we making sure we get the best insurance rate? How are we finding little perks and options for our employees to have? We said, hey, we're not knowledgeable in this, so we got a great partner to help us in that process. So it gave us the horsepower, it gave us the expertise, and it also gave us the way to know, like, we're making sure, like, we're raising our hands saying we're weak in this area, but we're going to find a partner that's strong. And that was a transformative aspect of our business. It literally transformed that business that eventually was acquired well after that I left. One of the key highlights from the CFO and the leadership team that they shared with me is like, Chris, there's no way we would have been at the point of this acquisition or know our business well enough to align our functional roles, to hire the talent, to compensate them, and to have them focused in our business, which led to an ultimate acquisition for them. There's no way we could have done that if we didn't have this human capital strategy. So a little bit outside the box, and some people may be like, Chris, that's not in my job description to go work with HR to develop a human capital planning and roadmap. But as a special ops project and really, really connecting to the people in the business, it was a tremendous project to work on.
Yeah, Chris, we've talked a lot on FP&A Fridays before about, you know, finding the time in the business to do certain things. And sounds like that was a business that had grown probably pretty quickly. Things had gotten messy. And that was the time to go and level set the organization in order to scale that next set of growth. And so that's why those types of projects are so important at those moments in time, right? Figure out what the special ops project is that's most important to the business at the time. And to scale after that, you needed that framework, that structure, that level set that existed after you did that work.
Most definitely. Yeah, it was that point. And we were 250 then, and then we catapulted to about 300-400 people in like 2 years. Like, it was rocket ship, and it was high level of growth, but it was that scale that we needed to make sure we maximize the investment that we were getting, to maximize the go-to-market strategy that we were having. It was a fundamental block amongst a lot of dominoes that needed to fall to get ultimately to that business where it was acquired by a competitor. And without that fundamental legwork, there's no way that business would have been at the position it was to get acquired. And some people got some nice paydays out of that.
Well, that always helps, right? So, Glenn, what have you seen? You know, you've been in FP&A for a long time. I'm not trying to date you there. I'm just trying to give everyone your experience. What are some of the amazing special ops projects that you've seen and tackled, and maybe cherry pick a couple of great ones for us?
Well, it's really covered the full spectrum. I've done a lot of the stuff that Chris talked about with HR, because HR is such a valuable partner. But one of the things that, and I'm going to take a little step back and kind of think big picture here for a second. One thing that I always like to do when it comes to putting together your goals for the next year is with my FP&A teams, I like to talk about, look, you got your fundamental things you need to get done, but what are the projects you want to do? Where are the other special things that are above and beyond outside of the normal realm of FP&A that you want to be working on? And it usually goes with, you know, if you have a finance business partner that works with HR, it's going to be a project with HR. If they work with sales, it'd be a project with sales, those types of things. But I always ask for people to be thinking about where does the business need to improve? And one thing that FP&A can do is it brings a discipline and a certain skill set to projects that many businesses don't have. And that is where the value is. That's where you could say what Chris described there was outside of the realm of FP&A. And I would say, why? What? I don't think that anything really should be outside the realm of FP&A, because we're analysts. We analyze information, we think through processes, we look at where should we be, where are we today, and how do we help get there. So all of that, to me, is all within the scope of FP&A. But I'll talk to you about a little thing that I did early in my career. I was at Franklin Templeton, and I was working, I was actually working in the portfolio management and trading group, which represented about 65% of their global revenue. And one of the things that I saw was that the business itself just wasn't working very efficiently, that you had independent groups that were managing mutual funds in their own personal strategies of how they were set up based on their brand. And they would go out and they would do their research, and then based on that research, they'd make their portfolio decisions on what to buy, what to sell within the mutual fund. But what I found was many of these different groups were calling on the same companies because they were investing. They had, there were some overlaps in how they invested. So, for example, Kukmin Bank is the largest bank in Korea. The global equity team invested in Kukmin Bank. The emerging markets team invested in Kukmin Bank. And the local team that was based, that was investing purely in Korea, was investing in Kukmin Bank. And one thing that I saw by sitting in an FP&A role, I'm able to see across the entire organization. I was like, wait a second. First of all, you have a local team in Korea that's going to get the data faster. And it has nothing to do, when you talk about researching, just gathering information, that has nothing to do with proprietary styles of managing funds. And what we ended up doing was looking at a project to say, wait, instead of having people flying all over the world to meet with the same company, why don't they coordinate, share information that is publicly available, because they have to deal with in public information. And this way, everyone's getting the data faster, and it's cheaper, and then they could leverage the questions and information that the other teams are asking. And what ended up happening was, is within 1 year of us instituting these shared research calls, we ended up reducing the overall cost to the shareholder of the mutual fund and the company. We improved the performance because the information was flowing in a much more timely manner, and the overall organization was running more efficiently. So does that have anything to do with FP&A? Maybe, maybe not, but you can go over and say, look, FP&A's job is to make the company more profitable, more efficient, more effective in whatever it's doing, just like what Chris was talking about with HR. And so here was a case that in FP&A, you saw this opportunity because you have a different view than others do in the company. You see across divisions, across portfolios, across products, whatever it happens to be, across countries. And you can say, wait a second, I see an opportunity here. And one thing that it takes, though, it takes the courage to go over and say, I think we could do better here, and I want to be a part of that.
I love that. We were actually talking this week internally about FP&A, and you know, Gartner talking about XP&A, extended planning and analysis, which is planning analysis outside the office of the CFO. And we were all like, isn't that just good FP&A, right? Like, isn't that just like, you know, we understand, we talk about XP&A and we know that world, but at the same time, it's just different types of data, right? It's operational data versus financial data, and trying to marry the two up. Really, really interesting there. What other kind of one thing that I've seen FP&A teams get really involved in is pricing, especially in, you know, fast growing software companies. But it's also an area where FP&A teams don't often have the most skills, right? Like, yes, they can do a lot of the analysis, but building pricing models and building pricing structures is a very sensitive topic for those involved, specifically the salespeople that have to go and pitch and message it. Have either of you been involved in pricing projects? I am expecting two yeses.
Yep. Yeah. Many companies I've done pricing.
Yeah. So yeah. Let's talk about it, because it's one that I think every FP&A person will tackle at some point. So what do you both have seen from, how do you go and tackle it, and what are the big risk areas around, you know, reviewing pricing models and coming up with new pricing models? And maybe Chris, I'll start with you.
Rowan, what a great topic to talk about, right? Talking about how you're moving from, like here at Amarsys, right? We have gone through so many different changes of product packaging to legacy pricing, where we're getting people on committed contracts from usage-based contracts. That's step number one. Then getting them on product-based packaging, where we went from, you know, offering all these different solutions to say, hey, you get our core product with all these extras, to saying, nope, you get essentials, you get advanced, you get max AI, right, to getting the packages. Now we're in a phase right now where we're going to, through the acquisition we're going to getting to new product and packaging that SAP wants us to have. So that, I mean, just seeing the different stages around that, where there's been changes. And to me, it's always about, like, what are you trying to go to market with, right? And I think in a lot of the software companies I've been at, we've changed our go-to-market strategy so many different times. Like the software company I was at before, which was recently was acquired, that I was mentioning in my FPNA special ops example. It was the same thing. It was, you know, we were going out there. We had people, we had customers that were the same level of customers paying $3,000. And we had that same level of customer paying like $25,000. And then we had a customer, smaller customer that was, we were all across the board, right? And the thing that we had to do was really, really focus on the strategy. And again, you hit the nail right on the head, Rowan. We got into the analytics. We were running the numbers. We look at customer lifetime value. We looked at, you know, the average CAC that was coming in from these customers. We looked at how much upsell, cross sales we were getting from different markets. We were slicing and dicing all that data, but none of that was valuable until we said, okay, what are we going to market with, right? Like, let's get a line on the strategy first. Like, are we, do we want to be the will fit it will, you know, in any deal, do we want to be the customer to say, oh yeah, we'll give you anything that you need? Or do we want to go in and say, here are the lanes that you could operate in, here are the products and the packaging that we're giving with it, here's the pricing you're gonna have, and based on your, you know, contact size or based on your revenue size or your employee size, that's how we'll determine what price point you're gonna be at. So really we had to get alignment and work with the sales, the marketing, the operations, and that group to really get aligned on what was our go-to-market strategy. So I think first start there. First start on significantly understanding the go-to-market strategy, right? And then now you can bring in the data to inform, hey, you know, our essential package should be at a $2,500 or less MRR. Here's the ideal customer profile. Here's the industries that they're in. Here's the AEs that we're going to assign to focus on that market, right? Here's the compensation and commission structures that'll go along with that. Here's the potential value that we'll bring to the business and looking at the total addressable market for those particular areas, right? So once we got on that, like once we got aligned on the strategy, how we're going to go to market, how we're going to position, what do we want our value proposition from a selling perspective to be in the commercial conversations? Once we got all that, and believe you me, that took a lot of time. You're getting sales, marketing, finance, strategy, operations, who's ultimately going to be the ones executing and fulfilling these things. Once we got all that legwork done, we were off the ground running. And that's where FP&A, we were able to accelerate the conversations, accelerate the packaging. And ultimately what that led to is like it gave us more uniform to know like, here's what a platinum customer is. Here's what a gold, a silver, a bronze is. Here's what that customer looks like. Here's what that market is in terms of revenue that it's bringing. Here's the upsell, cross sales that we can get from that. And here's the marketing strategies that we need to have positioned towards that. So for me, that pricing conversation is less about the numbers and more about how do we want to go to market, that alignment and that strategy. Then you can get into the quantitative aspect of it. So you know, in three different software companies, that has always been the natural transition. And me learning now on the SAP side with the acquisition is seeing how they do stuff and like seeing how they do it in different markets and how they spread things out. It's opening my eyes to a completely different pricing model. But for me, that's the kind of the framework that I've used in the three software companies I've been a part of.
Yeah, I have a funny story about a smaller company I worked at. And to your point around, it's about the what's your go-to-market position. You know, our pricing model was fine. It worked. People understood it. It wasn't overly complex. We could upsell. We could manage everything. And so everyone liked the pricing model. But we felt we weren't getting the, you know, our dues in the market. And there was a perception about us. So we just doubled the prices, and guess what? Customers just paid more, and they actually treated us more seriously. And it was just a perception issue that, you know, our price, we looked cheap, and therefore the product didn't show off well to them. And so just by simply doubling the prices, right? Pricing models, everything, like there's also a way of not overcomplicating pricing sometimes, which is you don't need to have all these fancy levers. If the levers are actually working, it might just be the price point, and that actually changes the trajectory of the conversation. Glenn, what have you seen? And I'm sure you've done pricing models in, you know, in banks and in at Digital Realty, your last company, which was leasing and things like that. What have you seen from pricing perspectives?
Actually, one of the biggest pricing models that I was working on was actually Charles Schwab. And Rowan, what you were talking about was the exact issue. It was the first thing you have to get to is, what do you, who do you want to be in the market? What are you trying to do? Do you want to be the, you know, the low price leader to say, hey, look, we're the cheap one, just, you know, where you have more transactional type volume? Or do you want to be the high end service that we're going to charge more for the same thing, but we're going to be higher touch? What is your model that you really want to do? And so, you know, that's the first thing that you have to figure out. And then there is some number crunching that gets involved, but what you really have to be looking at is consumer behavior. Or, you know, or if it's, if you're going out to a retail market, at least consumer behavior. But what, how are the customers going to be behaving based on the pricing? So you need to go and say, wait a second, if we raise our prices here, do we lose business? Where is that? If you think back to your economics classes in, you know, in college, the very simple supply and demand charts, you raise prices, your demand is going to go down, but it's about maximizing that box that is your profit, if that's what you're going for. By the way, sometimes you want to go over and you don't necessarily focus on pricing driving profit, you know, driving or more maximizing profit. Sometimes you want to change your pricing to maximize market share, which means you might be taking a loss. And so there are different strategies about what you really want to get out of your pricing and out of the market. So Chris was absolutely right. That's the first thing you got to understand. But then you have to dive into different types of numbers, which is more about how do consumers behave? Where is the market? Where is your competition? How do you want to position yourself? And it's really more about the strategy and how all those different pieces fit together than saying, hey, look, here's the actual price. Because at the end of the day, what you're going to do is you're going to have your model that's going to say, at this price, we think we're going to have this amount of volume, which tells us, here's the impact on the financial statements. You know, here's the profitability. Here's the revenue you're generating. Here's the growth potential, those types of things. But you first have to figure out, who do you want to be in that market? What is the brand all about, and how do you want to position it? And of course, as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, and I think back to my days at places like Visa, where they had a dominant market share, pricing was less important, because if Visa increased their price by 2%, well, they had more than 50% of the global market share at the time in electronic payments. Okay, they can do that. But you have to be very careful at that time about raising prices, because then you get into other types of laws that are around monopolistic behaviors and how you price. And so all of these different factors come into play. But it's really about understanding where you are, why you want to change your prices, what you want to do, and what's the ultimate outcome.
And so as we go and start that, right, where we've all decided, someone says, CEO says, we need to look at pricing. And he points at the CFO and says, you go lead that project. Who does the CFO, obviously turns to FP&A, right? Because it's a future forward looking thing. But who else do you need to bring into the room, and at what points?
So if I could jump in here. So the first thing that you, even if the CFO comes to me and says, hey, look, we got to go and look at pricing, the first thing you got to ask is why. What are you trying to get out of it so you understand?
Yes.
Right. But then you want to go over and you want to talk to people in product. You want to talk to people in sales. You want to talk to people in marketing. And if you have a strategy group, you need someone there too, because you're going to need information on that external market. Where are the competitors? You need to understand, how are you positioning yourself against your competitors? So really, it's not... FP&A cannot do a pricing exercise by itself, because if you try and do it by yourself, you're going to miss a whole bunch of things that just FP&A is oftentimes just not exposed
to. Well, you're going to do it twice, that's for sure, because you're going to go and do it. You're going to do it on your own, and then you're going to present to a few people, and they're going to tell you that there's no way that's going to happen, right?
Well, I would say,
sometimes you might not be doing it twice. You do it once, they look at it and say, no, you completely missed the mark, and we're not having you do this anymore. And they do it without you. The whole thing is that you want to be a part of the discussion. But being a part of it, you have to recognize you have to be part of a broader team. And that's where you have to have people understand the external market, understand the clients. You might have people from client service. If they are interacting with clients, this way they know, hey, how are clients complaining about our pricing? What are other factors that we need to bring in? So you got to have that real 360 view here to make sure that you have someone representing all the different areas that are going to be impacted by a price change.
Yeah, I would agree. If I can chime in on that with Glenn, you knock it out the park. Totally right. And I think, like, when I think about a pricing conversation and that being brought up, that's a new chapter being opened in that business, right? At least from my vantage point. Every time that I've been a part of a revamping of pricing, it's been a milestone in where the business is going, right? Sometimes in a SaaS-based business, you go, you're just getting, you know, you're setting everything up and you're like, $99 a user per month, put it on the credit card, right? And then it's just like, it goes from that way to like, okay, we need to get a little bit more sophisticated. Then it goes to like more packages driven, right? And then it goes, you as you escalate in the business, those have always been like checkpoints that I've seen, at least, you know, high growth entrepreneurial startup kind of companies, is that's always been, hey, we're going to another growth, we're starting a new chapter in the business, right? Back to like who you need involved in the conversation. Pricing conversations are like, imagine a lake and you throw a boulder in the lake and all the waves that come through that lake. Pricing is going to affect everybody in the organization, HR, legal, sales, marketing, operations. It's a big monumental atomic thing that you got to make sure you have alignment on. That gets back to my point earlier, is like, you got to spend the time on alignment. And I would tell people, like, seriously, being in those conversations, it's going to take a lot of time to get that. Or if you're in a fast-paced organization and it's just you, the chief revenue officer, the marketing, the operations person, legal, and you guys all get in a room and like, look, let's get this thing together first. Let's get aligned on all this. Make sure we're all on moving in the same directions, because that's how you run faster. So to me, like, when you need the people in that conversation, it's every touch point in the organization, because you're going to be driving more money. You're going to be getting more cash. You're going to have opportunities to, you know, people want to know, is like, hey, the first thing on the sales side is going to say, if you increase the price, what's that going to do to my commissions? The most important question you need to answer in that and know in every aspect of the business is, what's in it for me? I think we talked about that earlier, right? You got to know what's in it for me. And to Glenn's point, what's in it for the organization? Like, what are we trying to do? Are we just trying to get more money? Are we trying to, you know, reposition ourselves? Are we trying to seem like we're more enterprise and not mid-market? Like, it's really answering a lot of those questions before you even dive into the numbers. Because if you go the number approach first, which I've learned, it's going to be wrong. If you go to a pricing conversation and your first decision and first instinct is go look at the numbers, you're gonna be so inefficient and you're gonna lose so much time already. Go to the people, go to getting the strategy, go to getting the alignment first.
Yeah, and from that perspective, people tend to go to the numbers first because they want to feel informed as they go into that strategy conversation. But what you end up doing is leading the witness, right? Or you come in with a hypothesis that is like, oh, now I've got a frame of reference that my analysis wanted me to go here, but everyone's telling me something different. I just wasted some time. So both what Chris and Glenn are saying, which is step back and actually wait for the strategy conversation before you go and do that. And it gives you much more efficiency, because you can then ask the right questions of the data versus just doing analysis for fun, right? Like, you know, everyone does love spreadsheets and does love doing analysis for fun. I think we all have been there where it's like, oh, let me go and find the answer to this question. I'd love to dig into this for a few hours and get on my big monitor and play around with numbers. But you can't do that in a pricing conversation because you're just wasting time. What, I think, you know, we've parked a pricing there. I think, you know, for folks that are out there doing a pricing conversation, tread carefully and go together would be the themes that we all heard here. What other special ops projects have you both seen that you think are worth sharing with the group?
Yeah, I think for me, I'll jump on that. Like, so I talked about the human capital one, right? And I want to talk to a project that I think is the first test case that I always tell everybody to start with, right? And I think if the listeners, and the whole purpose of this is provide experiences for you guys to take and tactically go, like, tomorrow, start working through. The first one is get to know and understand the business, right? What is driving the money? What is driving the business? So I learned this back in my public accounting days, right? And yeah, I'm giving a highlight to all the listeners that are Big Four. Like, what's up? I'm Team E&Y all day. Let's get it. But for me, one thing I loved about Ernst & Young and that experience was like the walkthrough and test of controls that I did at Eli Lilly, right? Like it changed the entire course of like my career. And walking through like a process and seeing like how Eli Lilly makes money, right? Like this is how Eli Lilly makes money. $1 billion household name that anybody in the world would know. This is how they make money. So to me, if you're looking for that special ops project to kick off and you want to be a valued advisor, you want to get outside the business, you want to get outside the GL, all right? You want to leverage some amazing tools like Planful and other tools, right? Like focus on what is it that drives our business. In SaaS, the things that drive our business, it's not necessarily sales, right? It's marketing. Marketing is the tip of the spear in any SaaS business, right? They are the ones that is creating the awareness, the lead generation, the opportunities, right? That's how everybody, you know, and SDRs, I would consider sales development reps or BDRs or whatever you call them. I would consider like that is the tip of the spear. So for me, the special op project that I love to work on and I would encourage anybody to engage is go work with the marketing groups, right? Go learn. Because there's a common marketing analogy, right? 50% of marketing dollars, people don't even know where it's going, right? It's out there in this abyss and like you're spending the money. You don't know what kind of ROI you're getting with it, what leads are driving it in for it. But getting that tip of the spear of an organization and working with that group or working with that sales group, if that is not a SaaS-based company, go start there, right? And the first place you can start, right? Don't start with the numbers and here's what our closed ones were. Here's our lead pipeline. Here's the spillage we got carrying over. Here's, you know, our estimated to close when opportunity comes from our West arisen from this person, right? No. Go understand the leaders. Go understand the concerns. Go and approach it from like, okay, I'm not going into this with my rifle. I'm going to go into this with my med kit. I'm going to go into this with my bandages and understanding and a different kind of hat on. That way, when I tackle this specific special ops project, maybe the special ops project is not even quantitatively driven. Maybe it's just understanding the leader and building a connection with them. Start there. Build a connection with Rowan, the chief marketing officer, and say, you know what, Rowan? I just want to put 30 minutes of the calendar biweekly, and I just want to talk and learn more about your business, right? And it builds on it. Then once you start learning more about Rowan's business, right? Rowan says, man, I really wish I would have known something more around this marketing strategy that we're doing. Oh, Rowan, like, let me be your support and let's dive a little deeper into that. Organically, you would get the projects from having that dialogue with them. Again, don't go and say, well, in the marketing group, I'm going to be looking at these special ops projects and this is exactly where I'm going to go. Understand the business, start with building the partnerships and organically come up together in partnership. Well, what those special projects could be or what those special ops projects would be. That would be my foundation. You can start doing that tomorrow. You can start doing that today. That would be the first place I would start.
I like it because there's no leader in any business department that doesn't have something that they want done that's financially, you know, motivating to them or financially, like they're like, oh, I wish I had someone with analytical skills that could go and do this thing. And so naturally you'll get, you know, maybe some tactical stuff that you're like, oh, that's not that fun. I can, you know, I can do that in my sleep. But if you keep doing those little tactical things, keep earning the trust, earning the respect, then, and you can do that really quickly, right? Leaders start to see that really fast. And then next thing you know, you've got this huge project and you're like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. it definitely will happen. So, you know, I really like that mindset, Chris, which is to just create the trust, create the bonds. We've talked about it, create the, you know, the relationships with your peers, and then the work will come. Glenn, what perspectives do you have from, you know, you've worked at some bigger organizations and I'm sure that's harder to do, right? Like you can't go at Schwab to the CMO generally and say, hey, let me put a biweekly meeting on your calendar.
Well, if you're the finance business partner, I would say you better do that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the role of FP&A. I've had throughout my entire career, I've had regular meetings, monthly meetings with each of my business partners who are they could be division heads, they could be in the C-suite, wherever they happen to be. And you have to build out trust. And that's, you start by getting to know them and getting to know their business and letting them build that trust with you by, you could be doing things proactively for them. They could ask you to do stuff and you deliver maybe a little bit more than just what they asked. And that's how you go over and you build that up. But bringing this back to some of the special projects, I would say other thing, I mean, first of all, Chris reminded me of a project I did when I was at Visa. And I had the chief marketing officer come to me. I was running profitability analysis. And he said to me, hey, I want to understand when I go out and spend whatever it was, $75, $80 million, who knows, sponsoring the NFL, what kind of impact does that have on our annual revenues? And, you know, that's a project that is not just about the financials, but it's tracking the data and the consumer behavior and trending and all of that type of stuff. The real funny thing was, is I came back to him, I said, it has absolutely no impact whatsoever. And he looked at me and was like, so you're telling me everything we do here in marketing at Visa, which of course is one of the biggest brands in the world, has no impact whatsoever? And I said, well, no, not in like the next month or two. I said, that's driven by the economy. You want to go and look at how Visa's volumes move is based on how much money people have, right? The more money they have, the more they spend. The less money they have, the less they spend. It was pretty intuitive, but I showed it looking at various metrics of like GDP growth and comparing it against the volumes and all that kind of stuff. But I said, in the longer term, when you start getting out 3, 4, 5 years, it's about understanding and seeing what name is in front of you. If Visa all of a sudden pulled back on their marketing and MasterCard, American Express were out there, more and more people, as they were thinking about what their next credit card would be thinking about MasterCard and American Express over Visa. And that has long-term implications. So understanding stuff like marketing, there's a very big difference between short-term results and long-term impact. And long-term is about the brand. Short-term is more about the transaction. And sometimes if you're going to be a sponsor of the NFL and spend a ton of money, that's not about a transaction. And you got to recognize, are you looking at something long-term or short-term? One other special project I'll throw out there that I've done at multiple companies is around compensation plans for sales teams. Understanding how you want to incentivize people. Where do you want to grow your business? Because I think about something I did at Charles Schwab. Schwab has a whole bunch of different types of products that they can offer their clients. And the financial consultants get paid on bringing in money to Schwab, but also based on the type of product. This is a very common thing in financial services companies. So you got to understand, what are you trying to drive? Getting back to, once again, what is the strategy behind it? Because certain products are stickier than others. Certain products are more profitable than others. Certain products are easier to sell than others, right? So where do you want to incentivize the sales team to say, look, this is a better product for our company. This is more about the direction we want to go. So we're going to pay you more in that area. These might be easier for you to sell. It's table stakes for just being in the business. So we're maybe going to incentivize you a little less. And where is that balance? Because at the end of the day, what you actually have to do is, it's not just about the revenue and the profit that the company makes, but it's also, how much money is that salesperson going to make? And are they going to have enough incentive to say, I want to be doing this. I want to keep driving business for this company. And are they going to be making enough money? Or are they going to say, hey, you know what? You don't pay me enough. I'm going to go over here to my competitor, or something like that. So you really have to look at not just what the financial impacts are, what the market impacts are, but what's the impact on that employee? Because now you're talking about their compensation, how they take care of their family. So it's kind of a different type of project, but oftentimes HR works with the business on it. FP&A is not always involved, but FP&A can add a huge value just from the analytical approach by asking questions, from being involved. So getting into compensation planning, which has a huge impact when it comes to growth, budgeting, forecasting, the whole thing, that's an area that FP&A should be raising their hand and saying, hey, I want to be involved in that too.
Yeah, in my experience, Glenn, in revenue operations, the thing that people miss, and I'm going to call this out when they're looking at compensation plans, is they don't align it back to the territory and quota plan that exists in that rep's territory, right? Because you can design the world's greatest compensation plan with all the great products, and you might say, oh, we've got this amazing product and we're going to give this great incentive and everyone's going to go and sell it. If that rep doesn't have the ability to sell that product in that territory, that just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist to them, and they will find it, and they will go and find ways around, you know, and try and find, or they'll just leave because they know that the, what's being compensated isn't going to help them feed their family, as you said. And a lot of salespeople are on 50-50 plans where, you know, like that has a huge impact on them. So whenever you're doing any compensation planning process, make sure that you're doing it at a aligned territory and quota level as well, because if you're not going back far enough in the process, you're going to miss all the key indicators for a sales rep and their ability to hit their commission, which is about their specific territory, their ability to sell into that territory.
And a lot of that comes to not just region, but country specifics. Where are you? What's the market like in the different things? I mean, a very simple example, if you're trying to sell, you know, cross-country skis, and you're in your area is New York City, it's going to be a lot harder to sell that than if you are in Vermont, right? That's how, you got to recognize the regional differences, but sometimes the languages, the laws, the cultures, that's where strategy really comes back into play. And if you notice one theme from everything that Rowan, you've talked about, and Chris has talked about, and I've talked about, when you get into projects, it's more about the strategy than it is the financials. The financials Thanks. Might go to support the strategy, but it's you got to have that strategy. You got to start with that strategy. You got to believe in that strategy. And that's the strategy that you are solving for. You're not solving for a number. You're solving for a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Gillian, you're right, right? In these special ops projects, right? I want to give another special ops project that is outside the business. So another special ops project that you FP&A listeners should be having with yourself. Take the business. Let's park the business, right? We talked about HR. We talked about sales. We got to compensation. We got to marketing. If you want to have a special ops project for yourself, right, do it's the same thing we just talked about. Do a strategy of where do you want to be in your career, right? I remember doing my own special ops project for myself, but I didn't know it was a special ops project when I was making the transition from accounting into FP&A, right? I did the public accounting. I worked at I was doing accounting at a high growth startup entrepreneurial software company. And I realized, I said, you know what? I need to take a step back for myself in my career. Taking the business out, right? I did a step back in my career and I said, where are my skills, passions, and talents? Where do I see myself in the next 5 years? What do I need to be developing and growing? And where do I want to have the most impact, right? A lot of those questions I just said, you take the same approach when you go inside the business, right? But I think it's important for listeners to know, you can take these same things and the knowledge that Glenn is dropping and the heat that Rowan is giving and apply that to your professional life and where you want to go, right? I've always looked at that and said, I'm at that point right now where I'm looking at, okay, Chris, where is my vision? What is the strategy I want to do? And where do I have the skill gaps? Where do I have the passion where I'm motivated, right? And do that same thing for yourself. So if you want to look at a great special odd project to do that has value that could transcend inside the business, start with you, man. Start with yourself. Start with looking at some of those things. And I think it's important for me to know that because I think we talk a lot about how ways that we can advocate in the business. But the biggest champion and the biggest cheerleader you're ever going to have in your career is you, not the company. So you got to make sure you're doing those things. And the frameworks, the approaches, the insight that we talked about here can equally, if not even more, be impactful in your own personal career as you think about that. So I wanted to share that because I think we haven't talked at it across that chasm with some of the listeners.
So I 100% agree with what Chris said. In fact, it's an exercise that I love doing with my staff, but I've done it with myself. Think about where you want to be in 20 years. Title, living, hobbies, married, kids, whatever it happens to be. Imagine a graph. right? So your vertical graph, I call the vertical line, I call stuff. The horizontal one is time. So you go out 20 years, and wherever that stuff is, all the way up in that upper right-hand corner, that's where you want to be in 20 years. Now, think about where you need to be in 15 years to achieve 20. Where do you need to be in 10 to get to 15? Where you need to be in 5 to get to 10? Where you need to be in 2 to get to 5? And what do you need to be doing today that will get you to, on that path to where you want to be going or where you want to be in 2 years? And what sometimes it is projects. I mean, there are, I think of people that I've had working for me who have said, you know, I would love to be able to live and work at some point in Asia. And so, oh, you know what? As a manager, that's great to know. So when I have a project around something for Asia Pacific, hey, I'm going to throw it to that employee. Let them get that exposure, that experience, those types of things. And a lot of times you can drive your own projects based on your own passions. But you, it really helps to understand, yes, where do you, yes, want to be? And one other thing I'll tell you is that if you draw a line from where you are today to that point in 20 years, it's a diagonal line. You can't always travel along that path. The whole thing, sometimes you go to the right, sometimes you go up, and it makes it kind of a stepped function. Every once in a while in your career, you do get to take that leap on the line. But what's important is also make sure you don't go down or to the left, and so that you're going in that direction you really want to go.
Yeah, I think we've all seen that cartoon of plan versus reality, and you know, the plan is that straight line, and the reality is, you know, you've got to jump over the rock, you've got to walk through the fire pit, right, you've got to do all these sorts of things. But Chris, Glenn, thank you both for bringing that self-reflection, that self-leadership that folks need to have to actually really progress their careers. I think a lot of folks rely on their manager to define their career for them. And the more you get up to management levels, the more you realize you're just still trying to figure it out for yourself. And that your manager, whilst they do have the best intentions, and you have to assume positive intent on your manager, they're trying to navigate that same journey for themselves, and they're trying to figure out, you know, how do they make themselves look good to their boss and all of that sort of stuff. And so you have to take that self ownership. It's your responsibility to go and tell your boss what you want from your next 12 months. And if that's not realistic, trust me, they'll tell you. It is definitely on you to define your career goals. And if you do what Chris and Glenn just described, then you'll find opportunities that you didn't think were existing, because people want to help. Like, it's human nature. We all want to help each other. It's very rare that you find someone that actually doesn't want to help you. And if you don't ask, you don't get. So, you know, for everyone out there, you know, things like what Glenn said, where it's like, oh, you know, I have this interest in traveling the world and working. That's how I moved to London for 10 years. And now why I live in the Bay Area and have an Australian accent is because I always expressed an interest to travel to one of my mentors, and they shipped me around the world, and it's great. If you don't do that, if you don't speak up, you might just leave that job and take another job elsewhere, and you've missed a big opportunity in your personal development.
Yeah, I think so many times, Rowan, and the whole goal of this conversation is about special projects, right? And we get some great examples. And I think talking about this one, you always have to be the master, right, of your own career, right? It's great to have advocates, and I've had that along the way. I've also had an experience, man, and I'll share this. Like, I had an experience where I was working with my manager. I'm dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's. I'm ready to step into a senior financial analyst role. I'm ready. I did everything that I could. I'm all the performance reviews. Everything was like there. And I'm like, I had complete trust in this person, and I'm going towards it. I'm like, yes, yes, I'm almost at the finish line. And the goalpost changed. And it was like someone completely outside the business. And it was like, hey, Chris, we know we're working towards a senior FNA role, but we're going to give it to this other person. And I could go back to that moment. I remember where I was just like, boom, it was just like, man, I worked. And from that moment, I realized I would never put my skills, passions, talents, development, and growth in the hands of anybody else ever. And if I'm not getting what I want, And if I'm not developing and going down the trajectory that I am, I'm going to be proactive about it. I'm going to give it time. I'm going to have the conversations. But if I'm not in an opportunity where I'm growing and thriving and being challenged and expanding myself, it's not the right opportunity for me. And you got to be willing to have that conversation too. You got to, you know, I've had that conversations with leaders and mentors that I respect now today. And I said, look, we come to the understanding that, hey, Chris, it's probably not the best place for you, for your growth. And we agreed upon it. It was like, hey, look, it probably is. Let's start working through how we find, you know, the best person that's going to be in this position, excited about the opportunity that they have now, while I find the opportunity that is best case for me, right? And a lot of people are so scared of that conversation. They run away from it. They don't have it, hey, because it's it. But at the end of the day, man, you have to be the master of your career. You have to take ownership for it. You have to take on this special project for yourself. That way you can know you're giving the best of the business. So I just wanted to share that insight.
Yeah, and I 100% agree with everything Chris just said. I mean, he nailed it. I always like to say no one's going to fight harder for your career than you will. And so don't rely on somebody else. And, you know, that is, I was actually, the funny thing, Chris, I went through the exact same thing in my career. I had a boss who came to me and he said, hey, Glenn, I was a senior financial analyst. He said, Glenn, I'm promoting you to director. And I was like, oh my God, above skipping manager, senior manager. He wrote down my title, wrote down my salary. He gave it to me. I went out, had lunch with a buddy of mine. I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting promoted to director and everything. My buddy went over, he talked to his boss and said, you know, I'd like to get promoted too. They started talking. All of a sudden, my boss came back to me and says, yeah, that's gone now. You lost it. And I'm like, what? How? Why would you say that to me if it wasn't a done deal? And then like 6 months later, he comes back and says, okay, I'm promoting a senior manager. I didn't even tell my mom, right? Nothing. And he went over and took it away from me again. And it was very clear that if I was waiting for somebody to make something happen for me, I was going to be waiting a long time. And so if I wanted to move up in the organization, I either had to say, look, I'm going to do this. I'm going to work hard here and I'm going to see if I could get that. Or I'm going to start looking somewhere else because this just might not be the place that's going to get me to where I want to be. And that's okay too. But you got to come to that realization and you got to recognize if you are relying on someone else to do something for you, it's not necessarily their priority because their own career is going to be first before yours.
Facts.
Well, I think, guys, we could probably. Thanks. We could probably leave it there today and give some folks back some time to go and think about, you know, how they become the special operations project for themselves. I think Glenn and Chris have just dropped some, you know, some personal experiences there. Think about that for your own career right now and where you're at and what you need to go and do to make that next step. And, you know, for those that are interested in doing 20-year planning, I'm definitely not that person, Glenn. 20 years is like...
I didn't know that. I, you know, 20 years from now, who knows? I may be a dinosaur by then.
Well, it's all about where you want to be, right?
Yeah, no, I love it. I'm a five-year plan.
I'm a three. I'm a three.
Yeah. So maybe that's just Chris and I like to move fast. So like 10 years to just 10, 20 is too far out. But yeah, I actually may do it just to surprise myself.
Well, I would also say it depends on where you are too. If you're coming out of college or you're like 5 years out of college, 20 years, half of your career, you could do that. If you're getting close to retirement, 20 years is a little silly, right? So it really comes down to where you are in the spectrum, right?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe my 20 years is my golf handicap goal, but that's another story. So, all right, gents, happy Friday. I hope you stay cool because it looks like it's going to be hot around the country. And have a great weekend, everyone. And we'll see you next Friday for FP&A Fridays live here on Clubhouse. Thanks, everyone.